Hi, this is Tiffany. I just wanted to drop in to our podcast today and acknowledge COVID-19. The Digital to Learn podcast has pre-recorded episodes, and we do plan to continue on with those during this time. But we also just want to stop and acknowledge everything that you're going through and let you know that we're all in this together. And we hope that now more than ever, you find our content about digital learning relevant and useful in your daily lives. Everybody stay safe, and we wish you some happy listening.
I have felt and continue to feel that the biggest impact that's going to be had for education and with VR, especially standalone VR, is going to be around web conferencing and virtual classrooms. I did some work with a company called WorldViz, and they and others have these virtual meeting environments where you can be inside Tutankhamun's tomb, or you can be on the battlefield of Waterloo, or you could be at the Louvre, or you could be standing on the top of Mount Everest, and you could really feel, I mean, genuinely feel like you are there.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Welcome to the Digital to Learn podcast. I'm Tiffany, and I'm here with my co-host, Brad Garner. Hi, Brad.
Hello, hello.
Last week, we had an opportunity to speak with Peter Campbell, who shared some really valuable information with us. And we're back today to be able to feature Peter for part two on the problems and possibilities in higher ed. If you missed part one of this series, please go back and check out the episode on our website, www.digitaltolearn.com, or on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Podbean. For now, we're going to jump right into part two with Peter Campbell. Let's talk about one specific area of change. You mentioned in your work with immersive learning and the company that you have that maybe higher ed just isn't ready, but that you're confident that eventually they will be for some of those immersive learning tools. For those listeners that are maybe new to immersive learning technologies, what are some tools that they can be using now and tools that they can look forward to in the future as they consider and begin to adopt immersive learning in higher ed?
Sure. So, at a high level, just for your listeners, it's important to distinguish what we mean by mixed reality or sometimes augmented reality on the one hand and virtual reality. So the augmented reality or mixed reality, that's what I was referring to earlier with the HoloLens, where you have an integration of the real physical world with digital objects, right? So as I mentioned before in that use case with HoloPatient, here you've got someone wearing a computer on their head, the HoloLens, and they're seeing a hologram in their actual physical space. In virtual reality, as the name implies, everything you see in that environment is virtual. There's nothing real at all. You can simulate stuff inside the virtual environment, but there's nothing actually real inside of that environment. So there are multiple use cases for where mixed reality or augmented reality makes sense. And there's lots of use cases for virtual reality as well. I would say right now, I'm the HoloLens and HoloPatient example notwithstanding, my belief is that virtual reality is right now the most mature of the two and has the most useful educational applications and will likely take off at a greater rate than augmented mixed reality will. And so I would point to Oculus. So your listeners may know that Facebook purchased Oculus, this virtual reality company, 4 or 5 years ago now. So Facebook owns Oculus. And because it's Facebook, Facebook has deep pockets and has spent a lot of time and money and effort getting the message out about the Oculus. One of the problems with the first versions of the Oculus, though, was that it required that your device that you wear on your face, because it looks like a scuba mask, right? Have you guys tried a virtual reality before?
Yep. Actually, we just did this week.
This week.
Okay. Well, good.
Love it.
Welcome to the immersive.
Almost as much as Circus Peanuts.
The blue pill or the red pill? Choose. So, yeah. So you've walked down that rabbit hole. We're good for you. So So you're in this fully immersive world, and inside that immersive world, there are lots of things that can happen. But anyway, back to the story. The problem with the early VR is that you're physically attached to a high-powered gaming computer, and it makes moving around difficult. And it has lots of, the early versions had these sensors that didn't work very well, and sometimes people would get motion sick, and it was challenging. However, two years ago now, Oculus, owned by Facebook, came out with what's called a standalone VR headset. And other companies have done standalone as well, but Oculus being the big leader, they came out with something called the Oculus Quest. And that for me was a real game changer. And you're seeing more and more now attention paid to standalone devices. And what that means is that you are no longer tethered, attached to an external high-end gaming machine. In fact, you're fully able to wander around in a virtual space and feel as if you are physically in that space. And if you haven't done that, if you or your listeners have not done that, you absolutely have to try it. It will blow your mind how compelling that experience is to be physically engaged in a virtual world, to move through a virtual space is in itself just astonishing. But for specifically to your question, Tiffany, to your question about educational application, having been in the synchronous learning space and having spent a lot of time faced with the good parts and the not so good parts with web conferencing and virtual classroom technology, I have felt and continue to feel that the biggest impact that's going to be had for education and with VR, especially standalone VR, is going to be around web conferencing and virtual classrooms. So I did some work when I ran my company Experial with a company called WorldViz. They're based out of Santa Barbara. And they and others have these virtual meeting environments where you can be inside Tutankhamun's tomb, or you can be on the battlefield of Waterloo, or you could be at the Louvre, or you could be standing on the top of Mount Everest. And you could really feel, I mean, genuinely feel like you are there. And as an instructor, you could literally / metaphorically, and this is the strange thing about VR, is that you can both literally and metaphorically do things at the same time. That's what makes it so mind-blowing. You can literally and metaphorically be somewhere and walking students through various phenomena, including not just what I mentioned, the actual virtual places, but looking inside of a cancer cell, or looking inside of a molecule, or looking deeply inside of the structure of a water molecule, trying to see in real time what that looks like at the molecular level or at the subatomic level. So the issue that I saw for a lot of students, and I'm one of these people, right? I'm actually not terribly STEM-y. I'm more of a word guy. I'm not a STEM guy. But for me, the problem was always around visualization. Like all these STEM phenomena that get described, it's really hard for folks like me to really say, yeah, okay, I get it. But what does that really mean? And one of the things that's missing, I think, for folks like me is the actual capacity to visualize these things and actually see for themselves. And if you could see something in its truest form, in a three-dimensional format, there's some research that suggests that there's a strong linkage between that capability, seeing things in their three-dimensional reality, in their true three-dimensional form, and being able to fully understand and comprehend that. So I think that the visualization piece plus the web conferencing piece that I mentioned, the ability for students to be able to connect with each other in really engaging environments, not just staring at your computer screen like we do in Zoom or Collaborate or WebEx or GoToMeeting, all these things, where those experiences aren't terribly interesting or compelling, but to be in a virtual space with others in real time and to be able to do things that you cannot literally do in the real world, but you can in the virtual world, I'm super excited about that. And like I said, I don't think it's a question if, I really do think it's just a question of when.
Yeah.
So when you think about those web conferencing examples that you gave, what are some ways that experience can be made more personal and engaging for students?
Well, I think the first problem is to make the devices themselves easier to use and less expensive. But the good news there, that's already started to happen. So I mentioned the Oculus Quest. That device is, I can't remember the latest price point, but it's $350. And setup is very simple. What's really missing then is for those students to be able to connect to each other through some platform. Right. So, so there are platforms out there. There's a company called Roomy, or a company, actually they're called Doghead Solutions. They've got a product called Roomy. Full Sail University has done some early work with their product Roomy to do precisely this, to make their classrooms more engaging, to be able to do things in VR that they couldn't do otherwise. There are some other institutions that are doing some work that are on the cutting edge there. But I think at scale, the problem that's going to be solved there is for students who are, back up for a second. So online education works really well for students for whom online education works really well, right? So that's a tautological statement, but it's, but it's important to say that there's a,
and we totally agree. Right? We totally agree.
Totally,
with
yeah.
That.
So that's exactly, well, what about for all those students for whom online education doesn't work really well? And there's a significant amount of research that suggests that online education doesn't work really well for students who really need some kind of real-time experience. And let's face it, everybody on the planet today, maybe not in the not-so-distant future, but still everybody on the planet today, their very first educational experience was in a face-to-face classroom of some kind, right? We don't have a virtual kindergarten. We don't have a virtual first grade. So we were born and raised inside of environments where face-to-face learning was primary and foundational. And I think for a whole bunch of folks that don't do well in online, they miss that. They need that. They want that real-time communication, raise their hand, get their question answered, be with people in real time. And so I think online is going to hit, and you're already seeing evidence of this, that the growth is continuing, but it's slowing down, that I think we're going to hit a plateau where online is not going to have that kind of scale that some people think it might. And what's missing is an online experience that really simulates the face-to-face piece, right? But we need to do it. We need to leverage online and make it available to folks in the same way that online is available to all folks, but not do it asynchronously, which is what online has been to this date, but do it synchronously. And I think that, so taking everything that I've argued about so far, the need for compelling experiences through something like virtual reality and the need to solve this problem for that great number of folks that really don't do well in online, to combine those two pieces together and create online experiences, synchronous online experiences that leverage virtual reality, that will make those students who have not done well in online suddenly be able to do well. And it's mostly about the experience itself. It feels real. It feels compelling. They get their foundational fundamental needs met about feeling that they're close proximity to other people. They can speak in real time, but they're not just speaking to their computer screen, right? And again, no offense to folks at Zoom. I like Zoom. It's all great, all good. But the experience itself leaves me a little cold, right? It's a little weird, right? Oh. And I think one of the strangest, little sidebar here, but one of the strangest things about all what a web conferencing tools like Zoom is that when you try and look at somebody in the camera, you can look at your camera, but then you're not looking at them, right? So to make eye contact, you make a choice. But if you're looking at them, they're looking at the top of your head slightly. So it's just from a design perspective, it's just fundamentally odd. But if you get the chance, and I would encourage you to check this out, you can try Facebook Spaces as well. Actually, Facebook Spaces is a free, it's not an educational application per se, but it could be used for educational context. But Facebook Spaces is a free tool where you can check this out. You can find out what it's like to be in a virtual space with another person. My goodness, it's truly compelling. So I think that's where we're headed, and I think that's how it's going to be useful for students in the not-so-distant future.
Well, you've given us tons of resources to check out. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You
you've had the role of an instructional designer and an administrator in higher ed, and then you've also worked for the learning management system companies and various others. So when we think about these changes that need to happen or creating learning experiences that truly are compelling and synchronous, I'm just wondering, where is the change going to start, or who needs to be around the table in order to make those opportunities happen? Because even at our institution, the institution that Brad and I are associated with, we want that. I think there's a collection of faculty and administration, and likely the LMS that we work with too, that really do want to have compelling learning experiences for students. But who's going to design those experiences and sustain them? Who do you see around the table as being the key stakeholders for that?
Yeah, and that's a really, really good question and a really hard question. And I think that's what most people are trying to figure out. So, at a high level, it's always going to require leadership from the administration, whether it's the president or the provost or somebody at a senior level. But as we all know, most top-down implementations in higher education are destined to fail because they don't get faculty buy-in, they don't get student buy-in, and they don't go in with the culture of the institution. Most successful educational technology implementations have been achieved at the organic grassroots level. And they take time to the earlier question before about, it's a glacial pace of change, et cetera. Yeah. And that's because it's one faculty member to another faculty member to a department, to a school, to the whole institution over time. So those do take a lot of time. But I think ideally what we could do is we will be able to incent leaders out there. And that's one of the things that I like to think I can do, is ignite the fire of possibility and innovation and imagination in campus leaders to think about taking some of these things I'm talking about seriously, but then partnering with faculty members at the institution and sharing that vision with the faculty members. So it's not a top-down implementation. It's rather as an evangelist, right? It's what we need to do. We need to see these evangelists in positions of leadership who position these possibilities and talk about this new world, all these new potentials with their faculty, and they get their faculty to want to buy in and move with them. That said, we're at a critical point too in where we are in education, where faculty are going to need to choose between, they need to fundamentally ask themselves, why am I doing this? Why am I in this position? And for a lot of faculty members, again, no offense, they got into academia because they love writing and research. That's what they get paid to do. Mm-hmm. This is, and research is extraordinarily important. But really having high quality teaching and learning experiences, I would argue, is even more important. And no offense to all my comparative literature friends out there, but yet another dissertation written on Virginia Woolf or on, Shakespeare or whatever. I honestly don't think we need a whole lot more research done on those various things.
I didn't think people who study comparative literature have friends. So are you suggesting they do?
Their books are their friends, yeah.
He said
yeah,
it, not
that's
you.
Right. That's right. That's right. But I think what we need to do is we need to have a vision of, well, why do academics choose to be in academia? And folks who are in community colleges, mm-hmm. this has always been, they've always, they know why they're there. By and large, they're there because they're there to serve teaching and learning. So we need to kind of address that particular piece. Now that's a long change there. It's the way that the industry, if I can refer to it as such, but the way the industry of higher education needs to change as well. And it needs to fundamentally change its core mission.
Another feature in that discussion is the fact that I would guess a vast majority of the people who teach in higher ed have never done anything else.
Yeah.
They've never been in jobs in business or other fields. to have that different perspective. They've gone from kindergarten through graduate school, and that's all they've done. That's all they know.
Yeah.
And it kind of slants their perspective.
Yeah, it's true. And I think part of what we need to do in terms of how we educate future academics is also connect them with better training and support around teaching and learning, around technology, around innovation, but fundamentally shift the conversation away from this sort of rarefied ivory tower research-driven publisher-perish paradigm, which, you know, it's been what it's been. But honestly, I think those days are over for a number of institutions, and it's only a matter of time before they start to feel the pressure around that needs to shift. I think the whole publish or perish paradigm, certainly for the R1 institutions here, that makes sense. And again, I'm not disparaging research and writing and academic work. It's extraordinarily important, but I don't think it needs to be done for everyone, every institution at scale. Right. I think most institutions need to shift to a model towards teaching and learning as their primary objective, that faculty are hired and promoted and rewarded and retained based on their commitment to teaching and learning, and that they're not punished for not being good teachers, because this is the other big elephant in the room, is that academics tend to feel at times like they're being watched, big brother, Orwellian kind of thing, and they don't like that. Understand, who would? Nobody does. But if institutions are focused on, really truly focused on faculty development, on professional development, and using technology to help educators discover where they're strong, but also where their weak points are, and they can use that technology to improve their teaching and learning, and the institution creates a culture around supporting faculty in becoming better educators, that's amazing. And that is totally a doable thing, because it's just a culture shift. It's just saying to your faculty mm-hmm. members, hey, we're going to do things a little bit differently. And don't worry, we're not going to punish you for this, but it is a new commitment. And it is now trying to serve students in a way that we've not done in the past. And you know, what we also have to recognize is that the students that are coming into higher education now are disproportionately low income. They're disproportionately first gen students. And we simply cannot do what we've done in the past. For us to be successful with this new wave of students, and for us to fulfill the commitment of higher education and deliver on that promise, it is going to take a fundamentally different approach. We cannot do things as we've done before. And so where does that start? Well, I think it does start with those campus leaders, as I said. But I think where we're seeing it most is around continuing education programs, or programs that are seeking workforce development partnerships with local employers, where they're serving the needs of those employers. Those employers typically grumble about the quality of graduates that come out of the institution. And rather than grumbling about them, my vision, and lots of organizations have this same vision, that institutions of higher education can form better, tighter partnerships with local employers, and be able to create pathways for students to go through their institution and into high-paying, well-paying jobs, careers that really deliver on the value of that education. And again, not just to turn them into widget makers, we can still help them train for those particular jobs and help those employers fill those entry-level jobs, but we can also do it by not sacrificing on some of the promises of a balanced liberal arts education. My argument is, do not throw the baby out with the bathwater, but be more focused on serving the needs of employers, but ultimately focusing on the needs of students. We want students to be able to graduate with very little debt. And if they do have debt, we want them to be able to pay off that debt as quickly as possible in jobs that aren't dead-end jobs, but are meaningful, that they're valuable. We focused for so long about being able to get students out the door, right? But now what we are faced with is, well, when we get out the door, are they thriving? Are they succeeding? Many of them aren't. So it's not just right. graduation, it's a focus on how students can thrive. And so if our institutions are now focused on helping students thrive and not just graduate, that's going to be the key change.
So much for us to consider. We started off this question alone with, you know, who belongs at the table when it comes to change and creating compelling learning experiences. And what I've heard you say is anybody at any level, faculty, student, administrator, outside employer, anyone that wants to have a voice can and should be there, and that it is a grassroots opportunity. And so our hope with the podcast and with all of our efforts is that we would just inspire as many people as possible to get to that table and work together to create those meaningful learning experiences.
Well, amen. So. Yeah. Hallelujah.
We've got for you all kinds of things that we want to feature on our website. I've been reading your LinkedIn articles and posts for a while now, including one that was published in December called Game Over or Game On for Competing in U.S. Higher Ed Online Market. I would love for you to send me more and more resources that you have that we can share with our listeners. But I think this is going to be a really rich podcast episode or two for
two
us. Two episodes for us to be able to refer to a lot of great things that you've worked on and written, and to link to some of those opportunities that you were sharing earlier with immersive learning and your startup company and other things. So
terrific.
Is there anything else that you'd like to leave for our listeners in this audio format before we just share everything we can on our website?
No, I think this has been I've enjoyed the conversation. I appreciate the questions and your listening. I think the key thing for me is again, coming back to that journey that we've been on, and maybe I could just describe it in a slightly different manner. So I said before that, you know, we've been focused on graduation, and now we need to focus less on graduation and more about this notion of thriving, but walk it back a little bit. The initial challenge was to open up access. Remember, I described the fundamental problem with higher education has been it's been mostly a rarefied place for the elite. So that changed in the 60s with the creation of the community colleges. So it was like, hey, let's not make this a rarefied place for just the well-heeled. Let's open it up to everybody. So the key piece was access, right? Open access. So we got a lot of people in. But then what we recognized over time is that, we're getting them in, but they're dropping out. The retention rate in community colleges in particular was and still is pretty horrendous. So then the change was like, no, we can't just get them in. We have to get them out. Oh, right. So you see all this sort of hand-wringing and teeth gnashing around retention and on-time graduation rates and completion. But this is where now this is the current problem is that we're recognizing that, hey, it's not just enough to get them to retain them and graduate on time. It's not just getting in the door and keeping them in the door. It's getting them out the door, but getting them out the door in a way that is truly meaningful, where they're thriving, where they're in a position to succeed. And so that's where we are today. And so to the extent that technology can contribute to that, which I believe it can, mostly around, as I shared, identifying skills, connecting with employers and using ecosystems, platforms to be able to articulate those skills and demonstrate those skills, that's really what's gonna be key. And I'll just quickly plug Instructure, so our acquisition of the company Portfolium last year. Portfolium is an incredibly exciting platform to do precisely this. I love Canvas. I think it's a great learning management system, but I got to say, I'm even more excited about Portfolium now it being part of the Instructure family. We as a company can start to deliver on some of the value that holds and start to solve some of these problems that I mentioned before. I think that platform will certainly be an important player of that. And if your listeners want to check that out, I would encourage them to go to portfolium.com and learn more about that.
Very good. Thank you so much for all you had to share
today. Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the conversation. Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much.
This has been the latest episode of Digital to Learn, and we'll look forward to everyone visiting the website for more resources and listening into the next episode. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are three things we ask you to do. One, come back and join us again. Two, tell your friends about us. And three, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.